This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Based on shocking true events, the new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, tells the story of a savage murder in a small town. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
From NPR, I'm Sam Sanders. It's been a minute. Today, we're talking about a TV show and a character and an actor making something transformative. I really do believe that TV can be transformative. TV shows can create these worlds where we see things we haven't seen yet and tell us that, yes, those worlds, those realities, they can be. And maybe they already are. TV helped us accept gay people and lesbians and the queer community before they were widely accepted. They introduced us to the idea of single mothers or atypical family structures or black presidents and lots of other things before those things were widely accepted. My guest today is showing us a character that is, for a lot of us, a thing that we've also never seen before, something not yet widely accepted, someone who is pansexual. That guest is Dan Levy. His show is called Schitt's Creek. It's on Netflix and Pop TV here on the U.S. and on the CBC in Canada. The character Dan plays, David Rose, David's maybe the first pansexual character I've seen on TV ever. He is attracted to men and to women and trans people and gender fluid people and non-binary people, all kinds of people. Dan made the show Schitt's Creek with his father, Eugene Levy. You've probably seen Eugene Levy in movies like American Pie or several Christopher Guest movies, which are all hilarious, talking about Best in Show, Waiting for Guffman, A Mighty Wind. Eugene actually stars on the show with his son, Dan Levy. Anywho, the fifth season of Schitt's Creek starts this month. The show is all about this very rich family who all of a sudden is very, very poor. So poor, in fact, they have to live in two adjoined motel rooms in a small town. All right, that's enough to get you started. Here's me talking with Dan Levy in person in L.A. I have to speak to you first about a thing that I saw in your Instagram feed probably like a week or two ago. I creep on all of my interviews' Instagrams before the interview because that's where you get the real stuff.
Yeah.
You were in Vegas recently and you won $3,000 on a slot machine?
Yeah. Well, a friend of mine and myself collectively did. We were sort of sharing one of those double seat sort of slot machines where you get two people sitting so we can both play.
Was it a themed machine? Because there's themed
machines. Wheel of Fortune. It's the only slot machine I play.
There's a Britney Spears machine out there in Vegas.
There's a lot of... There's like strange 80s movies that I couldn't remember like and was reminded because they have a slot machine.
Yeah.
Sat down at the booth and got a Wheel of Fortune and suddenly it's $3,000 and there's an attendee from the...
Oh, they come up to you when you do it?
I think anything over $1,100, someone comes up to you and you have to like, it's like income.
Did you feel like the bell of the ball? Were you like model waving to the whole casino?
I was stunned. My friend was screaming.
Yeah.
Granted, she had an edible. and I was like in a state of shock.
Yeah.
And we ended up going to the bar at the hotel that we were staying at.
And blew all the money.
We got $50 whiskeys on the rocks, celebrated, and immediately left Las Vegas.
Oh, yeah. Because the thing is, you can't take that money you want and gamble it again.
Oh, no, it's not going back into the casino.
Can't
are you crazy?
That. Yeah. What are
That's
you going to
spend it on? I have no idea. Life. Rent.
Talking about Vegas, this place where there's so much money and so much excess.
Mm-hmm.
It is interesting to think about you in Vegas and compare that experience that you had there to the experience that your character has in Schitt's Creek, because it's all about having no money.
Having had money.
Having had money
now
and then
having no
none.
Money. Yeah.
It's such this juxtaposition. Like, how hard is it for you to get in the headspace of the character that you play on that show? This is the son of rich parents who used to be rich. The accountant was doing some screwy stuff. Mm-hmm. They lost the money. They have to live in a motel.
Yeah.
How do you get there?
Well, I think there's a big difference between... Because in my life, I have led a comfortable life. My parents have... My dad has managed to succeed at his craft. So, you know, it's not like I was struggling in my life. But one thing that I think the big discrepancy between, you know, people who have grown up with families who have money and what I'm playing on this show is the choice for these parents to give their children everything. And that was sort of where my path really diverted from this character's, because, you know, at 15, my parents sort of dropped me off in front of a Gap Kids and said, don't come home until you have a job application. So it was
not made, even the real Gap. The
it
Gap
was
kids.
No kids. Well, I chose kids because I didn't want to deal with people my own age. I was too anxious at the time. And like, I can deal with parents and kids. I don't want to deal with people from my class at school. They were adamant that I earn my own money, that I know the value of a dollar, that I never take for granted the experiences that happen in my life. And as a result, I have been, you know, working from the time it was legal to work and have been paying my own way ever since. So,
which is good.
Which is how it should be.
Yeah.
But there are so many people out there, families who have, who are drowning in money, who fix problems, who spoil, who, there's just this culture of wealth now where it's almost like the children become status objects for the parents.
Oh, yeah.
So if the children have lots of money and go on expensive vacations and, you know, are bought expensive homes, they are essentially sort of these weird appendages of this, which I think is a strange thing and something that I found very fascinating, which is why I ended up writing this show.
And you wrote it with your dad. So, like,
I wrote it with my dad, yeah.
Were you inspired by seeing spoiled rich brats in life?
It was like 7 years ago. So it was around the peak of the Housewives and the Kardashians and...
It's still peak housewife for Sam Sanders. I mean, it'll never go away.
Listen, it's only on an upward trajectory.
That's right.
But I remember at the time having such an intimate understanding of how these people lived their lives to the point where I'm like, this is taking up space in my brain. And like, no offense to all of these people. But, you know, I think these reality shows really allowed the masses to feel like in a way they're living vicariously through these people, or it's aspirational or whatever. And I felt like we had now this whole sort of world to play with, a world that most of us now know exists and sort of know the inner workings of. So if we were to take advantage of that in terms of just a core premise and say, well, what if one of these families who seem to alleviate the problems and the burdens of family drama by just throwing money at issues and buying gifts as solutions instead of actually sort of working out the guttural sort of like day to day of how it works as a family dynamic. That could be a really interesting sort of world to play with.
Yeah.
This family has lost everything and now they have to just live with the basics.
Yeah. In this town called Schitt's Creek.
Right. Which was
the family
purchased.
Bought.
My dad on the show bought it for me as a joke because of the name. We thought it was very funny. The family had no intention of ever having to move there.
Yeah. And they have to move there and stay in two adjoining hotel rooms.
Motel rooms. They'd kill for it to be a hotel room. And, you know, for us from the very beginning, it was always intended to be an exploration of family values and what is really important at the end of the day when all the money is gone and when all the materialism is sort of stripped away, what's left and what do you really need to get by as a family? And ultimately, I think the answer is love.
Always the answer is love. So you went to your dad with the idea. Was he like, bah! Or was he like, yeah?
Well, he was very excited.
Okay.
He was very excited.
Had y'all worked together before?
No. I think that's part of the reason. I think growing up in Canada, I got a job at MTV very early on, and I worked there for about 8 years.
You were a personality. You hosted
I was
stuff.
A host, yeah. And we ended up doing some stuff here with MTV. We worked for The Hills. We did their after show for a long time. But it was still based in Canada. And I was hyper-sensitive to the label of nepotism going into that experience, that I didn't tell anybody that I was who I was or who my dad was.
When you were doing your stuff with MTV.
When I was at MTV, at least for the first half, so 4 years.
Really? You think folks knew?
Whether they did or didn't. They didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. And I think most of them didn't. Okay. And it allowed me to find my footing mm-hmm. and realize whether I had it or not.
And you did.
And I mean, I did in the sense that I was continually employed.
Yeah.
So
which is a feat.
I wasn't
in
messing
this
up
economy.
That bad.
Yeah.
And then once I felt like I had my footing and I had a voice of my own and that people were responding to what I was saying on television mm-hmm. for me, mm-hmm. I felt more comfortable to sort of let him in. Mm-hmm. And we worked a little. We did a few little sketches for MTV at the time.
Oh, nice.
And then when I came here, having left MTV, I felt like, A, the idea that I was bringing to him was strong and that I knew what I was talking about, and I felt like I could
bring... Well, because you had watched these reality shows and also had after shows about some of these reality shows.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if I were to sort of, like, connect the dots through my sort of strange,
yeah,
weird career on television, I'm sure it would... It all sort of led to this.
Yeah.
But I knew that I could sort of stand my own ground with him mm-hmm. and that I wouldn't be taking advantage or that I wouldn't be sort of coming to him, relying on him to... get me work or mm-hmm. get me something.
I mean, you could both do the heavy lifting.
We could both be in it together. I mean, I'm not going to lie. He definitely helped in terms of opening doors and getting meetings.
Yeah.
But it was the idea ultimately.
And it was your idea.
Well, it became our idea, but it started as mine. Sure.
Yeah.
That ultimately got us on television. And it really sort of, we sat down and started talking and, you know, it was an idea that I thought could use his sensibility, his comedic sort of sensibility, what he had brought to the Christopher Guest movies that he had co-written with Chris. And we started working on it and his process was very different than mine.
How
and
so?
It was, he's incredibly thorough. Hmm. And at the time I didn't have a process. So it was just generally different.
Yeah.
But it was, I mean, working with him behind the scenes and then on camera has really been the greatest masterclass in comedy and acting that you can have. I mean, you can't pay for that kind of experience.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it has not gone. I've not taken a single day for granted.
It's good. And so, like, you have this idea. You and your father write this, create this. But then also, your sister is in the show, too. This is like a family affair.
Yeah.
And my whole thinking in prep for this interview, I was like, I can't imagine any world in which I went to work every day with a parent and a sibling. I would go
it's
crazy.
Wild.
Do you like it?
Sure. Here's the thing.
Say that.
Even when things, I mean, working with family, I mean, my sister and I get along really well, and we get to see each other on set, and she'll come in a couple times a week, and that's been great. I mean, working with my dad every day, it's one of those things where you have to almost make a conscious effort to try to react differently
mm-hmm.
in situations where there's discrepancies or where you have disagreements, because the reaction would be like, "Ugh, can you just?
I hate you." But you're on set with, like, other people.
Yeah. And also, you know, you have to almost draw a line for yourself. But at the end of the day, we both have the same end goal for the show. So any sort of conflict or discrepancy or disagreement will be resolved because whoever has the better idea that serves the show the best will, in a way, win.
Yeah, yeah.
And also to sort of look back at this from sort of like a meta standpoint mm-hmm. to have a you know 6 or 7 or however long the show goes to have that kind of chapter of your life that you've gotten to share with your family that's not only in the memory bank but also
documented
is something a lot of people don't get.
It's a scrapbook. I love it. So I'll, you know, tell friends and family what I'm preparing for in the show. Mm-hmm. Everyone that I talk to who I'll say I'm going to interview, you know, one of the stars of Schitt's Creek. And they're like, oh, my God, that show. Like, it is. Are you so, like, the fandom is real. Like, the people that like this show love this show.
Yeah.
What do you think that's about?
We're lucky, I think. Mm-hmm. We have really passionate, mm-hmm. smart, mm-hmm. Caring fans who feel the show in their bones.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a combination of the show just being quite joyful,
yeah,
trying to send a message of love and acceptance. And I think that message being sort of put out into the world, it's in a way provided some kind of
respite.
Lightness
yeah.
or escape for 21 minutes and 50 seconds or however long you want to binge it for, a way to sort of take your mind off of what's happening and lean into joy for a little bit.
All right, time for a break. After that break, dear listener, Dan talks about his character's pansexuality and his early work acting in Lifetime movies. BRB.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by Discover Card. You check things all the time, like your email or social media. But Discover asks, what about checking something as important as your credit score? Well, Discover makes it quick and easy with their credit scorecard, which is free for everyone, even if you're not a customer. See your FICO credit score and other important credit information. And once you know your score, you should check to see if your current credit card is the best fit for you. Learn more at discover.com/credit scorecard. Limitations apply.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to dig into your character a little bit. David Rose on the show.
Yeah, this is, sweet thing.
I know. I really do like him.
Just tries his best.
Would you like to hang out with him in real life?
I don't know. He's a lot.
Describe him for folks that haven't watched the show yet.
David Rose is an incredibly privileged human being who has never really found his voice. Mm-hmm. And as a result, has sort of created a persona for himself that is dependent on an aesthetic, his clothes, what he wears, an entirely black and white wardrobe of highly architectural clothing.
Yes.
And a just as prickly a personality.
Yes.
And in moving to the town, David has, in a way, found comfort in the anonymity of living in this place and has allowed himself very, very slowly to open up and reveal his wants and needs to people slowly and carefully and surely.
Yeah.
I think he's a pansexual, so he's been able to explore all sides of the community.
Oh yeah,
in Schitt's Creek. And has eventually, you know, found love, and I think that has really changed his whole outlook and made him realize that he doesn't have to be as protective. That he, that loving someone, that finding love in your family and finding love in a partner can allow you to feel safe in this world.
Yeah. I love the way that you handle pansexuality with this character. It is not the central defining thing about David Rose. It's just there. And there's this beautiful moment in which his character comes out to one of his partners as pansexual, and the word pansexual isn't even used.
So, just to be clear, I'm a red wine drinker.
That's fine.
Okay, cool. I only drink red wine.
Okay.
And up until last night, I was under the impression that you too only drank red wine. But I guess I was wrong.
I see where you're going with this. I do drink red wine. But I also drink white wine.
Oh.
And I've been known to sample the occasional rosé. And a couple summers back, I tried a Merlot that used to be a Chardonnay, which got a bit complicated.
Okay, yeah, so you're just really open to all wines.
I like the wine and not the label. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
So in that scene with you was?
The lovely actress Emily Hampshire, who plays Stevie Budd on the show. She's a dear friend and really was quite wonderful in that scene.
That's really good. Was that your idea?
I wrote that section.
That's great.
I think it's, I don't know what episode it was.
It was in the first season?
Yeah, it was an analogy
episode 10.
That came to me that I thought was very much a way of communicating his sexuality that, again, didn't come with some kind of lesson or it wasn't heavy-handed.
And not academic. I think you hear the word pansexual and, like, you're like, what does this mean? Yeah. It sounds harder than it really is.
Yeah.
And I think the way that you tackled it in the show made it really understandable.
Yeah.
And it didn't, like, it wasn't you trying to not be that as a character. It was just saying, let me break this down for you real simple.
Exactly. And I think that sexuality right now is in such a wonderful state of
flux.
And all we can do with one another is try to inform people as to what everything means. There's so many, you know, different terms. There's so many. There's a whole vernacular now that we're having to sort of understand, and it's all for the best. But I think we have to just approach this sort of new territory with the idea that everything is, as long as you're coming into the conversation with the best of intentions, we can't create a judgmental environment. We have to be as open and accepting and malleable when it comes to, okay, this person doesn't quite understand who I am.
Yes.
I'm going to tell you without
preaching,
being offended or without, making you feel bad, because ultimately we should all be sharing in this process.
Yes.
And when people feel included in the conversation, they're far more willing to cheerlead.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people sort of stand on the sidelines because they're scared.
They don't want to get it wrong.
Exactly. But I do feel like if we can all come at it from a place of just optimism and the best of intentions.
That's the thing. Assuming the best
intentions. Hopefully that can.
Yeah.
Because the only reason people have had to take these stands is because somewhere down the line, someone decided to define sexuality as one thing and then splinter it off into two things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if that were never in the equation, if sexuality was just what it was.
And it wasn't always a binary thing. We forget that.
We would
that,
never
like,
be in this situation because labels are what have led to bigotry and intolerance and people feeling judged or people being persecuted. It's because someone has labeled someone else as different.
Yeah. Did you know from the start that you wanted your character to be pansexual?
I did.
Why?
I hadn't seen pansexuality represented on television.
Nor have I.
Before. I mean, I'm sure it had been, but I wasn't aware. I thought it was interesting territory to explore. For the character and for the show.
And you aren't burdening this character with message, all caps. I think a lot of times when you see a first on TV in any capacity, there can be a desire to have that person be a brand ambassador and have them give respectability to this community or something. I don't see that on his character, which I appreciate.
Thanks. I mean, I think there's two ways of going about it, and I think it really depends on the message you're trying to send and ultimately on the medium. But I think for us, I guess the stance that I took was that I'm going to show a life as it is in the world. It will not be questioned. It will be embraced. But there are some shows, I think, that need to be more educational in the way that they approach sexuality because of who they're speaking to or because of what they're saying. That just wasn't ever going to be what this was. There was going to be no homophobia. There was going to be no bigotry. There was going to be no
magical dream world.
Listen, and you know, I think there's a people have said, well, is that a responsible thing? But at the end of the day, it's a choice. It's a choice that I made.
Yeah.
And it's a choice.
It's also a fictitious show. You can do it.
It's a fictitious show. I can do it. And I also, you know, we've gotten the most incredible feedback from families across the world who have watched this show. And I think because of the fact that they aren't put in a position where they're forced to make a judgment, where parents are accepting of their children, where a small town is not raising an eyebrow to two men falling in love with each other.
After one of them fell in love with a woman.
After one of them has fallen in love with a woman. It has opened people's eyes and in a way made them look at themselves and say, well, why am I having this problem when these people
don't have a problem?
Why am I having this conflict with my child when it's so much easier
just to love?
To love. And that has been the feedback that has really been that has brought me to tears, because for that message to be sort of like going out there into people's homes and for people to be for families to be repairing relationships because of what they're watching in our show is truly incredible and very humbling.
Do you hear from pansexual people?
Yeah.
What do they say?
a lot of them have just are really just excited that there's someone who represents them on TV, that mm-hmm. they watch a show mm-hmm. Where they can finally turn to their parents and say,
"Hey,
this
look.
Is it. This is who I am."
Yes.
But yeah, again, the major feedback predominantly over social media is just mm-hmm. that it's not, they're not being taught a lesson.
Yeah.
That people are not, it's not, we're not spoon feeding sexuality
yes.
to people. So
yes.
they like that it's sort of casually represented.
One thing I notice about all of the characters is that they have really perfected this sense of comedic timing, which is beautifully on display because you're not doing laugh tracks. You're not killing it with like music and scoring. So you'll just like deliver this amazing joke and let it just sit there with you. But my question is like, your comedic timing in the show is on the same level as your father's character, and he has been doing this stuff for decades. What did you learn? I mean, did you learn stuff from him in terms of just like being comedic on screen?
Well, first of all, that's a wonderful compliment.
Yeah,
The character, I don't know where he came from, but okay. It just happened. And it's funny because I was writing those scripts up until the night before we started shooting our very first
really?
Day. And it wasn't until that night that I sat down to learn my lines that I was like, oh God. I have a scene with Catherine O'Hara and my dad tomorrow.
Yeah.
And this is my first time acting since a Lifetime movie that I did with Misha Barton.
Whoa. You can't just drop that bomb and not let it explode. What was this movie?
I can't remember the name.
It had you can't something remember to the do. Name of your own Lifetime.
There were two names, one in Canada and one in the States. It had something. I think one of them was.
Say it.
I think it was called Cyber Stalker. Anyway,
were you the stalker?
I mean, yeah. It was a very bizarre film.
You know, I'm going to watch this tonight.
You really will regret that. You will halfway through really wish you had that time of your life back.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
I sort of showed up on the first day.
Yeah, that was your experience, whereas like your father and Catherine O'Hara had been in improv for a long time, movies for a long time. They just had this depth of experience.
Of course. And, I mean, they know what they – I mean, they're – incredible character actors,
and they know each other because
they know each other. They have an innate sort of gift to read a script and to extract a character from it. I had a very loose idea of what I wanted to go in with. I knew that he was really guarded, mm-hmm. and that he was using sort of a very sort of hard shell to protect himself.
Mm-hmm.
And when we sat down, I really do feel like I attribute a lot of him to Catherine and my dad and Annie in those first few scenes where we started to be a family.
Did your father give notes on set? It's like, you didn't do it like this. I know
well,
what
it's
I'm
funny because we did shoot a presentation pilot a little bit before we got the green light to do a series. And uh-huh. I sort of did a version of David then, and he was very soft-spoken. And in the show, he can tend to be a little like, you talk sort of in the back, like there's a judgment that exists
in the back
of this. And I remember my dad sort of coming to me saying, I don't know if the mics are going to pick up that kind of voice.
Yeah.
But I didn't know anything about mics at the time.
Yeah. But there was this essence of, which I love, like almost an essence of like Tim Gunn, but even more condescension.
Oh, yeah. With like a combination of Meryl Streep and Devil Wears Prada. And
why is no one ready?
Yeah, her whole approach was that like really powerful people speak softly to force people to listen.
I love it.
So.
All right, one more break. When we come back, some stories about the many times Dan interviewed celebrities for MTV, featuring one of my favorite Beyoncé stories. All right, BRB.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Rothy's. Rothy's is the everyday flat for life on the go that comes in four fashionable styles for women: the flat, the point, the loafer, and the sneaker. Fun designs and patterns while still looking polished and professional, with new colors launched every few weeks. Best of all, Rothy's are made from recycled plastic water bottles and completely machine washable, so you can feel good about wearing them. Go to rothys.com and enter code MINUTE to get your flats and free shipping.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Dan, I want to go back to your work as an MTV host. Do you miss that?
No.
Why not?
No, I never felt comfortable hosting TV.
Why not?
Never. No. I would be really nervous. Depending on the person who came in, if I really liked them, I would get nervous. And if I really didn't like them, then I would get nervous. it just never felt right.
I do love the beauty of never having to show my face. Like, one, I'm fidgety.
But you're so good at your job.
Your check's in the mail.
But it's true. I mean, and also I think, you know, we were doing this on live TV, and it was very performative.
And there are time constraints, which is
incredible.
Crazy.
Time constraints. Yeah. A lot of, you know, people come in with mandates from publicists where you have to hit X, Y, and Z, and also not being able to have a sit down and have a conversation like this. If I were given the opportunity to chat like we're chatting now, it would have been a totally different thing, because I find this to be very sort of fulfilling. But on MTV, it's like, you're asking, like, so who are you dating? It's amazing. Wow. Whoa. Your album's great.
And it's not great.
And it's fine.
Who was your most favorite and least favorite celebrity interview in your time? Or can you say?
Funnily enough, the great thing about being on MTV is that a lot of people came in. A lot of people came through the doors. And in certain situations, people that you never thought you would have the kind of fan reaction to, you got. Tori Spelling came in to the show at one point.
Okay.
And I will always be a 90210 fanatic.
All right.
And she came on, and for some reason, some kind of repressed something kicked up in me, and my glasses fogged. I started sweating. I couldn't talk properly. I had no idea what was going on. And the, like, wave of, like, nostalgic fandemonium hit me so intensely that I just fell apart.
Was she like, oh, my God?
I don't know. At the time, I thought, like, that went well. If I were to watch it back, I don't know.
I also love that you've coined the word fandemonium. I'm into that.
You said fandemonium. Us Weekly.
Oh, really? Okay.
Probably put that out a while ago.
I'm into it.
And Adele was a great one.
But what
and
level
Rihanna
of Adele?
Was a great one.
Wait, stop!
Yeah. Twice
what?
I interviewed Rihanna, yeah.
But what level of Rihanna-ness? Was she like as big as
Umbrella
she is
Umbrella era? No, it was it had been 8 years, I think, since I left.
Okay.
So it was
early.
I mean,
Rihanna.
She was still
a force.
There were hits.
There were bops. Slaps.
Slaps. she was great. Adele, I had actually seen in London.
Okay.
Or heard in London, her first album, 19, had heard it in London, came back, got the job at MTV, heard she was touring with 19 in a very small venue in Toronto, sat my team down at MTV and said, we need to bring her in and we need to have her sing. And they said no, because at the time we were only putting on like Sum 41 and like pop punk stuff. And they didn't know what it was. And I said, okay, you have to trust me on this. I'm
She's
quitting
good.
If you don't bring her in.
Give me Adele.
She came in. We did the interview. She performed to a room of like 60 people.
Wow.
You could hear a pin drop.
Wow.
It was, and I knew in that moment, we all knew in that moment that she was going to go on to be legendary.
And she's a good interview too.
Lovely and humble and completely enthusiastic about her success.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it doesn't ever feel like she's taken anything for granted.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the best kind of celebrity. That's
You
know, people that you can sort of share in their excitement.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's happening. It's big. You got tons of money now. What are you going to do with it?
Yeah. It's also my thing with Adele, who I love. At some point when people rise to prominence on breakup songs and songs of despair, I feel like, personally, I want them at some point to make the switch and make an album about being rich and happy and married and having a kid.
Maybe that's what the next one is.
It better, because
who,
like,
knows when that next
I'm
one's
like,
going to come.
Are you happy now, Adele?
Probably.
You've been
very
gone
happy.
From that man for years.
She has a kid and
yes.
a big old house.
Yes.
She's doing great.
I want, you know, like, Spirit Fingers Adele next album.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, this has been everything I wanted it to be.
I'm so glad.
I want to close as we started and talk about Las Vegas.
Yes.
If you could put any artist in a Vegas residency, who would it be?
Beyonce. How much do you think Beyonce would have to get paid to do a Vegas residency?
Also, how many shows?
Like Jeff Bezos money.
They'd have to
and
give her
she
Amazon.
She would be at Caesar's Palace for 4 years.
Yes.
Coming out with like $400 billion.
Oh, totally. Because you know that there's like Beyonce stands that would just go to 15 shows in a row.
Me. I would be there. I would be there every weekend. There'd be a shuttle service.
Yes.
From Los Angeles.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
I saw her in Atlantic City when she did the residency in Atlantic City.
Her best shows are when it's just her.
Well, I
Formation was better than Underrun
2. Unfortunately,
you missed Formation?
I missed Formation.
Girl.
And that was the
Girl.
Only
Girl.
Show that I have missed.
Girl, Formation was beyond.
I know. I don't need you to tell me.
She walks on water.
I watched enough clips over Twitter and Instagram and
she
YouTube.
She literally walks on water.
I know the water part. You know, there's probably a DVD out at this point and I'll buy it and really regret it. But even in On the Run 2, where you're only getting half of her.
Yes.
That half is better than anything else out there.
Yes.
And I looked over at one point and Annie and Noah, who Noah plays my boyfriend on the show and Annie plays my sister, were like mouths agape in a state of just shock.
Yeah.
Because to watch her perform.
It's superhuman.
Is to witness something surreal.
I saw her in Baltimore on the Formation tour and literally the most beautiful moment that I've ever seen in my musical history. Mm-hmm. So like the audience at a Beyonce show is really, you can define it. It is gay men.
Yep.
Women.
Correct.
And women that bring their straight men with them.
Yes.
And so there was this straight woman with a straight man in front of me. This is a white woman. She's living her life, mm-hmm. loving Beyonce. But the man, the husband, is not into it. He's just sitting there drinking his Coors Light. But this was just after Prince had died. So at a certain point, she begins to do a tribute to Prince. And she breaks into this perfect rendition of Purple Rain. And as she's singing Purple Rain, you see the guy be like, oh.
Slowly get into
yeah.
it.
And then she hits the chorus. He grabs his Coors Light, stands up and goes, woo! And you saw the moment where she
was
got
converted.
It was the most beautiful thing
she
I've ever seen.
She will get everyone.
Eventually she'll
it's
get a song.
It's only a matter of time.
Yes. Send her to go solve the shutdown.
Wow.
She could bring folks together.
Holy cow. That's a whole other
it's a whole other story chat. For the next time.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you. This was delightful.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
What a pleasure.
Come back for next season, too.
Done.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Dan Levy. Seasons 1 through 4 of Schitt's Creek are on Netflix right now. I've been binging. You should as well. The 5th season of that show starts this month. And listeners, as always, today, tomorrow, any day, share with me the best thing that's happened to you all week. That's for our weekly wrap on Friday. Just record yourself, send the file to me at samsanders@npr.org. You may hear yourself there, in the show, on the radio, all over the place. All right, till then, thanks for listening. I'm Sam Sanders. Talk soon.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Get the service you deserve. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Sattva. Sattva luxury mattresses are every bit as elegant as the most expensive brands, but because they're sold online, they're about half the price. Visit SAATVA.com/NPR and save an additional $200.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.